Okay, thank you. Good evening, everybody. Thank you to the Franks for hosting. So, if you look on the front cover, this is a special throwback for me because when I was growing up, we had a history teacher in high school who, if I'm not mistaken, is still teaching my nephews in the high school that I went to growing up. And one of his great things, some of you know I enjoy history, one of his great things was he actually would Xerox for us and share with us political cartoons on a regular basis. That was part of our understanding of political science, was satire. So when I was thinking about ideas for this year, I couldn't help myself. I needed to Google for some political cartoons. So I hope you enjoy the one on the front cover, and I hope that the person who did it is mocking me for borrowing it for this year. I think his name is Sack, I guess. It comes from a Denver newspaper. So our discussion tonight is focused on the concept of privacy in light of various revelations recently about email hacking. Now, as most of you know, I don't work for the NSA. I have no insight into the CIA. My father works for the government in the Social Security legal department. So I don't have any secrets here. I don't have any insight, except to explore together some of the aspects of the Jewish tradition on this question, which is becoming more and more of an issue in the modern day world. You know, for a long time, Nachum and I were reticent about doing online banking because you get nervous, you put all your stuff on the internet, and who knows who's breaking into whatnot, God forbid. And then after a while, you realize, even if you're not banking online, everything that you have and everything about you is there whether you like it or not. So you may as well get the convenience out of it, because so much information about us, even if it's not us putting it online, the bank is putting it online. And the other agencies or companies that we work with, or if you purchase something, like, the information is out there. And the number of breaches of security over the last couple of years go from like astounding to mega astounding. And so you have different kinds of criminals. You have people, I guess, who spend their lives in some hole in Eastern Europe somewhere, you know, looking for computer data. And then you have, you know, people who are interested in other kinds of cyber criminality. And then you have the most interesting latest discussion, which is about email hacking by Russian government officials into the Democratic National Committee's emails in advance of the election and stuff like that, which is probably why it's not just me. I think that this caricature on the left side in the Kremlin looks like Donald Trump, but I can't say with certainty. So what do we say about email and protection of email privacy? Sometimes when I get emails, when I get emails from people, maybe even some people in this room, there's like a block of text on the bottom. It says, if you share this with somebody else, you will die, and the government will come after you, and, you know, threatening all kinds of bad things will happen to you. You see this on the bottom, you know, but, you know, I don't know if people pay attention to that. And if they take it seriously. The question is, what do we, as halachic observant Jews, think about this? So if you look on the first page of the packets, you have a very important tshuva, and this may be the oldest source. There's a Kolbo, but I believe that this is the oldest printed source of what we know colloquially as the cherims of Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom or Hagola, so he is probably the most famous. Do we need more packets you have down there?
Yeah.
Probably the most famous of the Chachmei Ashkenaz, just before the turn of the millennium. So he's living and teaching and guiding the Jewish world from his seat in the Rhine Valley. And Rabbeinu Gershom institutes a series of enactments. Now, not all of these enactments... We got a place. That's great. Welcome. Okay, we should have some more packets floating around, otherwise we'll share. Okay, great. We're just getting started. Everything so far, preamble. So the Rabbeinu Gershom is attributed to enacting many takanos, many rabbinic enactments. So probably the most famous and the most widely discussed of the Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershom is the prohibition against polygamy. So that's probably the most famous of the Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershom. There is another Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershom about not divorcing one's wife against her will. Coercive divorce is a Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershom. And this is what you're looking at in front of you, is a Prague edition of the Tshuvas of the Maharam of Rothenburg. See, the Rabbeinu Gershom, Mo'or HaGola, he did not write down his enactments. He didn't formalize them. And by the way, not all of the enactments that we associate with Rabbeinu Gershom are personally attributable to him. They are from that rabbinic school, from that time period, and from that group of rabbis who are living. So remember, where are we talking here? We're talking pre-Crusades Germany. You know, all in the Rhine Valley, in Mainz, Speyer, Worms. These are the three major communities in the Rhine Valley. And from there, you have questions coming and enactments going far and wide. And there's a lot of discussion about Sephardic and Ashkenazic relationships with this. You know, the question about polygamy is specifically Ashkenazi heavy in the discussion, whereas this, what we're going to talk about tonight, is actually, as we'll see shortly, is very much embraced by the Sephardic community. So if you look on page 1, this is the Tshuvas of Maharam of Rothenburg. Maharam of Rothenburg, he dies in 1293. So he was not a direct disciple of the Rabbeinu Gershom. He's living a couple hundred years after Rabbeinu Gershom, but he's living in Rothenburg, and before that he lived in other communities along the Rhine Valley. So 1293, so now you're talking after the Crusades, which, just for historical context, you know, the destruction of the Crusades of the Jews of the Rhine Valley did not actually, and this Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik points out, did not disrupt the halachic life of Ashkenazi Jews and the halachic creativity and the world of learning. And the reason is because with Rashi, Rashi's born in 1040, with Rashi, his move, he studied in Worms, but to Paris, the suburbs of Paris and Troyes, Rashi's move to France takes the vast majority of Torah learning into France. So when the German communities are decimated, the learning is perpetuated by Rashi. Then the Balei HaTosfos, Rashi's grandchildren, then create their students who then migrate back, and that's why Maharam of Rothenburg is living in Germany. So in 1286, there is a series of a problematic anti-Jewish decree, which was not uncommon if you were, let's say, a German lord or a knight, and you needed money. So the best way to get money was to promulgate an anti-Jewish decree. It's just the simplest way to get cash. So there were Jews who tried to leave Germany, and then they came up with another edict which said, you can't emigrate. So Maharam of Rothenburg, Reb Meir of Rothenburg, who was the undisputed religious leader in the German Jewish community, tried to smuggle out and made it, I believe, as far as Lombard, when an apostate recognized him and turned him in. So he was then sent to a prison, and then to another prison. He was in two different prisons, and the German community wanted to ransom him because he was the greatest rabbinic leader. He was their Rebbe. But he refused. And why did he refuse? Exactly. And that's why several, most prominently, the Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel, the Rosh, he left town. He left with his family to Barcelona, got his way through France. Now they got out of there because they realized that this could become a bad habit of the local Gentiles. So the Maharam of Rothenburg died in prison. In, I think it was a place called Inchesheim. He was in two different, one was Wasserburg, another one was Inchesheim. And his bones, his body was not redeemed for 7 years until there was a man, a German Jew by the name of Alexander Wimpfen, who ransomed with his own money. He decided it was enough is enough. So he ransomed the body of the Maharam of Rothenburg and buried him. But he was the undisputed great rabbinic leader, and the Maharam of Rothenburg, from the tower where he was in prison, continued to teach. He had students who would come to learn with him, and he would write letters, shuvas, that he would send to different places. So the Maharam is a very, very important figure, but he's also a huge figure in terms of codifying the halachos and the practices of the German community. So he has a whole section way at the end of these tshuvas. So that's why on the top you see what it says, Chu Mem Beis Beis. Mem means Meir Ben Baruch. Meir Ben Baruch, that's the shorthand for Maharam of Rothenburg. So Maharam of Rothenburg has at the end, this tshuva is like tough, reish something, all the way at the end of the tshuvas Maharam of Rothenburg. And he collects a bunch of the Chayrim Drabbeinu Gershoms, including that is what you have in the underline here. Chayrim shelo liros biksav chaveiro, not to look at the letter of your friend, shesholeach lachaveiro, that he sends to his friend, below yediaso asur. Without the person's knowledge, it's prohibited to look at it. V'im zorko, if the recipient threw the letter away, then it's permitted. So, you know, you see a letter in the mail, let's say you're a mail carrier. So the Chayrim Drabbeinu Gershom says that A is sending the letter to B, you're not allowed to open the letter, you're not allowed to look at it, but if B threw it in the recycling, so if you're the recycling collector, then you can look at it. So this is the source of this principle of not looking at other people's mail, which ostensibly should be true also for email. Not hacking into other people's email, it should probably be the same. Well, the question is, well, why? What's the reason? What would you suggest is an underlying reason why we should not allow sneaking into other people? Yeah?
I have a question. Why is it okay to look at it when the guy throws it in the wastebasket? I mean, it seems to me that he still, what's he supposed to do with it? Pile a collection and put it in a safe.
Great.
He's got to do something with it.
So, I guess there's the practical answer, and then there's the lumdish answer, which we're going to have to get to. What's the practical answer? So, we have in our house a shredder, and anything that is not supposed to be, you know, I don't know. I don't do the papers anymore in our house, so whatever Nechama says needs to be shredded, I shred. I don't do the bills anymore. So in theory, that's what really should be done. And the fact that the person is discarding it, so what's happening here? You have A, right? A, who's the sender, and B, who's the recipient. Well, obviously, the sender is giving the license to the recipient to use that information as they see fit. They're giving them the letter. Now, if the recipient thinks that that is confidential information, it shouldn't be privy to anybody else. He should throw it. In a place, right? You should throw in a place where it's going to get burnt up. You should put it in the furnace or something. So, what's underlying? So, we could suggest a couple of different options as to why it is that you shouldn't be able to read somebody else's mail. So, if you look on the first, on the next page, page 2. Okay, this is not the easiest text to read, but I couldn't find another edition of the next. This I could find another edition, but I wanted you to see it in the inside just because you can get a feel for it. This is a Shuvah's that I found a reference in the Encyclopedia Talmudit, and I tracked it down. It's called Tshuvas Toras Chaim. Toras Chaim was authored by Rav Chaim Shabsai, who was born around the year 1550 in Salonika. Mm-hmm. Now, why is this?
Oh, you're not from Salonika, but I have a book about a Jew from Salonika.
Okay, so why is this also significant? What's that? All right, it's Sephardic. That's what I'm trying to get to. Why is this significant? Because it's going to be interesting that even though in Halacha there's a big discussion about the Chayrim Rabbeinu Gershom as it relates to marriage in Ashkenazi communities, and the Sfarim are like, well, maybe it's not binding on us, maybe it expired, so we don't really connect to that. But you'll notice that the Sfaradic Poskim are mentioning this Chayrim about not reading other people's mail. So this is 1580, let's say. I don't know exactly when this was published. He died in 1647. He becomes the chief rabbi of Salonika. So this is, he's known as the Maharchash, Rab Chaim Shabtai. So he has a letter. And if you see on the right-hand column where the number 1 is, so this is the third volume in Simon Mem Zion. Nidrashti, I was asked, and I'm going to read it through for you. Maybe it's not the easiest print. But now you feel what it was like if you were living, I guess, in Salonika. This is what... No, this volume was... I don't know when they published this edition, but I could not find a more... I found it in the Bar Ilan, but the Bar Ilan is... It's very... You know, it's like just regular typeface. You don't get the feel of the Sefer. So, Nidrashti Asher Sha'aluni Al Ruvain. It always happens with Ruvain. Shehaya Sholeach Ksav Chosum Im Charmos Olav Lazar Leir Acheres. Reuven was sending a letter to another city, and on it they wrote Cherem. So by the way, this is actually the source. There is a separate tshuva, which we'll reference a little bit later, called the Shuvas Halachos Ketanos, who was asked, what happens, in the old days, they used to actually write on the front of the letter, Cherem Derabbeinu Gershom, and also Pagin. That was an acronym. Pei Gimel Yun Nun. Poreitz Geder Yishchenu Nachash. If a person violates the cherem, so you're giving them a curse. If somebody breaks the law, poreitz geder, you break down the fence, yishchenu nachash, you should get bitten by a snake. So if you would write somebody a letter, you would write, cherem derabgenu gershon, pagin. Poreitz geder yishchenu nachash. That is actually, I believe, the source for the people writing the drop-dead confidentiality thing on the bottom of their email. That's like the modern-day equivalent of writing pagin. So the halachas ketanos was asked, what if you get a letter that it doesn't say that on the front? Does that mean that you could just open the letter because it doesn't say it? So his answer is no. You still can't open the letter, even if they didn't write on the front, drop dead for opening. Okay. Anyway, so
someone in Cherem, is that connected at all?
Yes. Generally speaking, the Gemara has this idea, which is where it comes from. The Gemara has this idea that if a person is violating a Cherem or a Dina Drabbanan, certain, like the Beis Din will curse that person, will say that he should drop dead. So that's the reference. It's Porich Skeder Yishchenu Nachash. So if somebody runs afoul of the rabbis, you may find some unpleasant demise. So Baruch Hashem, that doesn't apply to anybody here, so you don't have to worry about it. Okay, so what happens? Reuven sends a letter. Baal Levi, I'm on line number 3. You see I put little numbers on the right side? Baal Levi, some other guy comes. V'natal haksav im ksav machirim. So he robs the mail. He steals the letter. Upascha. Then he opens the letter, v'kavash haksav, and he holds it, v'lo nasno liyad mishenishlach elav, v'shalu mimeni madino ulaze. What's the din? The guy steals the letter in the mail, opens it, and then keeps it. And you can imagine how this could get interesting, depending on the circumstance. So the shaila comes to Rav Chaim Shabtai in Salonika, what's the halacha for somebody who does open somebody else's mail and then obviously keeps it? Keeping the letter is stealing. That's of course stealing. But what about opening the letter? So he writes in the first, in line number 6, Omer Biktzara Devada Roy Liyaser Lelevi. You should definitely punish Levi. So what's the logic? So this is the interesting on line 11, because Mistama, line number 10 at the end. Mistama shalevi sha'asa zehayal l'shum to'elas hamagia lo mizeh ha'boel. Levi, the guy who broke into the letter, he probably did it for a reason. There was a motivation. So he says, v'havale d'mishtamish b'shal chaveru b'li yediyaso. That is the equivalent of using something that belongs to someone else without their permission. And we have a principle, Shoel Shalomi Das is a goslin, is a thief. A thief. So this becomes a very interesting discussion in halacha. Some of us are familiar. Let's say you go to shul and you forgot your talis at home. You forgot your tefillin at home. So there's a whole discussion in Orach Chaim, are you allowed to borrow somebody else's talis without asking them permission? So there's a discussion. Well, are they particular about how they fold their talis? You know, a lot of people, let's say, if it was me, let's say I don't do this, but let's say like in many of the shuls, like in Or Torah, they have cubbies, and people leave their talis there and they leave their tefillin there. So I came to shul, you know, and I see somebody's tefillin there. Let's say Rabbi Engel left his tefillin, so I know he wouldn't care if I borrowed his tefillin. Like most people, they wouldn't care if you borrow the tefillin. You put it back exactly the way that they did. But this is a discussion in Shulchan Aruch. If somebody's very particular or they fold their talis in a certain way, they don't want other people messing with their talis. But certainly, you know, otherwise you're not allowed to do that. That's Shol Shalomi Das is a goslin. It's a theft. So this is the first approach. By opening somebody else's mail, you are stealing something from them. Maybe this is kind of, there's a big question in halacha about intellectual property. How does halacha regard intellectual property? Well, this might be one model. What exactly are you stealing by opening their mail? Well, you're using some information. So maybe this isn't intellectually, owned by somebody in some way. That's one angle. Take a look then on line number 24. So he says, after he mentions, of course, the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom, which we mentioned before, line 24, Roy Ligdor, Mikomokom, Roy Ligdor Gedol Yasser. We should punish somebody who violates the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom. And in line number 24, Uma Gam Im Garam Hezek, Labal Haksav. What happens if you damage the person? You know, somebody could claim that in this election cycle, somebody was damaged by the revelation of the stolen emails or the disclosure of these emails, right? There's two parts of this, actually. There's the stealing of the emails, and then there's the publication of the emails. So this is another interesting point. Grama benizakin. And then he says there's another level. There's grama, and then there was what we call garmi. Garmi is more direct. So let's say, what would be a case of grama? Grama would be, let's say you have a backyard full of vegetables, and I own a goat, and I let him out in front of your house, and he's going to run to the back of your house and eat up all your animals. So that's grama benizakin. I didn't eat up all your vegetables in the backyard. I didn't eat your vegetable patch, but I let my animal go right nearby. So that's grama. But here's a different question. That's a basic level. Here's a higher level. This is usually referred to, although garmi is a very complex question. Let's say I do the following. Let's say you have a check for $10,000. Now, a check in halacha is very complicated, but let's assume right now for a second that a check is a shtar. Why is a check a shtar? A document. Because what is a check, as far as I understand? Right? That's what it is. Meaning, when I go to the bank, they don't have your money if you write a check for $10,000 to me. They say that you are signing on this document that they can come to your bank and take $10,000 out of your bank account, right? That's how it works, essentially. So there's a big discussion, by the way, that's a big question in halacha, how to use a check to pay. Let's say, you know, can you marry someone with a check? Can you sell chametz with a check? A lot of interesting questions about checks. But, we should find. You know what a check is. So,
negotiable instrument.
Great. That doesn't help me.
That's the clinical term.
Great. So let's say you have a check. Someone comes to your bank with a check. They give you a check that says $10,000. You have to give them the money, right? Because you don't have to give them the money?
There's laws. You know, the next day availability for certain amounts.
Okay, eventually they're entitled to get some. If it clears, great. So the check, let's assume it's a shtar for a second.
But in reality, money is just an IOU also. I mean, a dollar is just the U.S. government pledging that they're going to make good on it.
Okay. Okay, so it's a good question. So maybe that's different than the old time.
I mean, when it used to be a dollar-backed, you know, a gold-backed dollar.
Right.
It would, you know, fit with coins from the olden time. Nowadays, it's all funny money.
Interesting.
But a check is actually a direction, an order to someone to pay.
Okay, so it's a shtar. It's a document that tells you what to do.
People would, Jews especially, created this as a means of direct traveling. So that they could take a piece of paper or parchment to another city. And the person in one city is giving a direction, an order to someone in this other city to pay this person. So you really need three people, the person who makes it, the people to whom the order is directed, and the person who's supposed to be paid. So they could pay it even if you didn't have money.
Uh-huh. Okay.
In that particular, with that particular person, but that person would honor it because it was part of their business relationship.
The deal. Okay. So that's also more similar to a
check.
Right. So how much does it cost? If I went into the bank and I asked them to buy one check, how much would they charge me?
Well, like currency exchanges charge 1%, 2%.
No, just to buy a piece of paper for a check. A check.
You can write it out yourself.
Yeah. You can print it on your printer.
Oh, yeah?
You can print dollars.
I like my day job. So let's say I went into the bank.
That's why they came out with all the new currencies. It's that easy to
print the money. Anyway, let's say I went into the bank and I asked you for a check. Let's say I paid you $4, $5 to get a check. So you would give me a check for $4.
We wouldn't have anybody's account number.
We'd have to figure out. Let's say I had an account with the bank and I didn't have a checkbook. Every kid, like you can't get anywhere. Just trying to get a case. So I have an account. I have a checking account.
Yes, they'll run it.
And
they'll
I want one check.
He's not telling
I
you.
I want one
they
check.
Run it through the maker machine.
Great.
To get you a check.
For $5. Then I write on the check. The check is made out to so-and-so for $10,000. And I give them the check. So now they're excited. They're going to run to the bank. They're going to get $10,000. And now I leave town because I paid off my debt. I owed the guy $10,000. I gave him $10,000. And then some smart aleck comes along, pulls the check out of the person's hand, and incinerates it. So now what? How much did he damage the check holder?
He stole $10,000.
So on the one hand, you tell me he stole $10,000 because now the guy's out $10,000 from his pocket. On the other hand, the Ganef will tell you it was $4. He just paid $4 for that piece of paper in the bank. He didn't stay. I didn't see any $10,000. I saw a $4 piece of paper. You want to go back to the bank? I'll let you go back to the bank. I'll write you another piece of paper. So what's that? So that's more than grumma. That's not letting my goat near your vegetable patch. That's called garmi. Garmi is much more direct. That's sorif shterosov shelchabero. That's burning somebody else's documents that are very valuable. The Gemara says that we have machlokas tanoim, but the generally accepted opinion is that you have to pay for garmi. So he has an interesting line of logic here, Rav Chaim Shabtai. He says, wait a second, when you open that person's mail, when you get that insider information, you may be violating damages because you may be hurting, let's say it's a business letter, let's say it's information about their company. So you could be violating Hezek through grumma, through indirect damage, or by opening that mail, you may be hurting them much more directly. This may be confidential business transaction information. And now that you're aware of that, you're going to take advantage of that person. And that's direct, not stomp some indirect maisa. That's dina de garmi. So he says, you gotta think about that also. So on the top left, I didn't put numbers here, on the fourth line, he says, ve'ein safek shepoel kazed. There's no doubt in my mind, he says, that this action, rov pa'amim gorim hezek, most of the time it does damage. Rav legalu sodas ha'adam. And va'afim lo ye b'momon ye b'dover acher. And now he adds another level. He says, it's not just true on a financial level, it's also true very often on an interpersonal level. How often is it that somebody by accident sends an email? I don't know if it's their mother, their mother-in-law, their somebody, you know, they get that email and after, and my email in the Gmail, it gives you like 15 seconds to undo.
Oh, really?
Yes, there's a way to do that. Everybody's like, wait a minute, what did I just undo?
Yeah.
But after that, lenetzach nitzachim, it's gone. How much hezek can be done if somebody went into somebody else's email and read all those mother-in-law emails? You know, like that could do a lot of damage. And sometimes that damage is worse than financial. So the first perspective on not opening somebody else's mail, we see, has to do with shol shalomidas, you know, using that information, potentially damaging them financially, but also damaging them in other non-monetary ways. So that's one perspective. Turn to the next page, number three. This is a little harder to read. You thought the last one was easy. Okay, this is Rav Chaim Falaji. Rav Chaim Falaji is one of the most significant Chachmei Sfarad in the 19th century. Dies in 1869 in Smyrna. He wrote over 70 Sfarim. Many, many Sfarim. Over 70 Sfarim. Great rabbinic Sephardic scholar. So he has the following tshuva. He says, what happens if you have the case? Here, this is in Chelek Yerodea, Simen Mem Tes, in the bottom right. He says, I had a shaila about a goy who sent a letter to another goy. A sends a letter to B, and the letter happens to be passing through the hands of some Jew. Now, it happens to be the person who is the Jew who's holding on to this letter has some debts and some business issues with the sender. So he's nervous. He wonders what's in this letter. So he writes, Rav Chaim Falaji, is allowed to open the letter from one person who's not Jewish to the other person who's not Jewish.
Are these real questions? Or are these
questions? These are actual real, as far as I can tell, these are real questions. Some tshuvas, it's true, like the Truma Sedeshin, his tshuvas are, he made them up in the format of tshuvas, but these I think are real.
So how long is he holding on to this letter waiting for the answer?
Right. You know, in those days everything went pretty slow, so it wasn't, it was okay. So so Reb Chaim Falaji says, well, here's the question. What's the rationale? What's the reason that you're not allowed to open somebody else's mail? So go to line 25 on the left-hand side. Umayati Ishlanu Lachkor. We should check. Me'eza Tam Usar Rabbeinu Gershom. And again, you see a Sephardic Rav invoking the Rabbeinu Gershom Chirim, now 19th century. Why did Rabbeinu Gershom Usar Dover Zeh? De'im nomar mishum mashikosav zal ala posuk ve'ahafta l'reacha kamocha. Maybe that's why you shouldn't open other people's mail. Because what does Hillel tell us? Ma'i da'alachsani l'chavach lo savet. He says, what you don't want done to you, don't do to somebody else. I would not want somebody else reading my email, so don't do it to somebody else. So then becomes the question, well, does ve'ahafta l'reacha kamocha apply to a Gentile? Good question. So on the surface of it, although there are some who disagree, on the surface of it, the answer is no. He's not one of your reacha kamocha. He's not a fellow. Go further. Go to line 40. Maybe it's a different rationale. Line number 40, number 41, he quotes this tshuva that we mentioned earlier from the Halachas Ketanos, from the verse 41, Ma lo selech rachil, don't be a gossiper. So maybe it has actually nothing to do with who's writing and receiving the letter. Maybe it's about you as a person. What kind of person are you? Are you so nosy that you're reading other people's mail? And then the last suggestion, he says, on line 45, Aval im ye isuro. Maybe the prohibition about reading other people's mail, mishum gonev das habrios. Because of gonevas das, misleading people, stealing their mind. And he says, the Gemara tells us, that Gnevas Das, misrepresenting yourself, stealing somebody's mind, is prohibited whether they're Jewish or not Jewish. You know, you can't fool people. You're prohibited to fool, misrepresent yourself, and it doesn't matter who they are. So if you understand that the Isser of reading other people's mail is a Gnevas Das problem, and in this case, it sounds almost like an actual stealing their Das, stealing their knowledge. I write you a personal correspondence. It's personal. It's my thoughts that I'm sharing with you. And if you come along and open it, you're stealing the thoughts that I'm supposed to be sharing with that person and not with you. So he says, if that's the case, then it would be prohibited. So the conclusion of this tshuva on the next page, on page 4, in this line, in line 22, he concludes that it is permitted in this particular case, because he's being matzil himself, and the circumstances in those days, very often when you dealt with Gentiles having to do with money, as is obvious from many other areas of halacha, it's not like we have today, where you have the court of law, where you have, you know, legal representation and due process. So when you dealt with non-Jews, things in those times are very different. But then he raises a fascinating shaila as a conclusion on line 25. V'im yiyeh b'inyan ha'inyan. That what? Oh no, that's what happens if the guy finds out about it. Okay, go down to line 30. 29. Ve'im yera inyan kazeh Yisrael im chaver. What happens if it happens between two Jews? Ubo lito rishus mi beistin sheyiftachu ha'igeres. Two Jews have a correspondence between each other, and then there's a third Jew who's not privy to this correspondence, who thinks that there's information about them in this. Can they go to the basin? Can they go to the rabbinic court? This is what we would call today, in legal parlance, a subpoena. Is it permitted for the rabbinic court to intervene and open somebody else's mail for some other reason? You know, this is the Department of Justice asking Apple to open up somebody's phone.
What kind of reason would they be giving?
Good question. He doesn't elaborate. He says, Yesh tzadim lekan ulekan. There are different ways of looking at this, and he doesn't give you an answer. So Apple says to the Department of Justice, we need to protect the privacy of our clients. You buy an Apple device, you don't want Uncle Sam asking us every day for information about it.
But at least Uncle Sam had a reason. They thought that either they were trying to track out right, terrorists
so, or... So obviously the rabbinic court is not going to go snooping into people's mail for no reason. So you're going to have to figure out what the reason is. But it's an interesting question that he's raising and not resolving, whether or not the Chirim of Rabbeinu Gershom the protection of somebody's privacy in terms of their mail applies to the rabbinic court.
But it's apparently between two Gentiles. The Jew has the letter.
Yes, in that case.
In that case, he said it's okay for you to open the letter because Gentiles may have something against you.
Correct.
Or something like
there's
that.
Some, exactly. There's some extenuating.
It still seems like you're stealing something.
So so in this case, it's because there's some trying to save your money, there's a mitigating factor as against the stealing cheshbon, which is what he's working through in this long tshuva. But the last wrinkle, I think, is very interesting. It's very analogous to exactly what's going on in America today. Somebody told me there was recently a case, I think it was Amazon, or somebody, some other major corporation, that the federal government came to them and said, we want information about...
Well, I think Alexa.
Yeah. Is that what it was?
Yeah, the murder or something.
Yeah.
I heard about it. What it was exactly.
Oh, right. There was some...
it's this thing.
The Echo.
Yeah. Yeah. And whether they would open it up and reveal, because apparently whatever's there is in a...
listen
in a cloud
to, listen
or someplace.
To courts.
Exactly.
Order people dollhouses or something.
They thought the sounds or the noises might reveal who actually committed the crime.
Okay. So isn't this a good mocker, this question of 250 years ago of Rav Chaim Falaji, I think, is really addressing that question. The Beis Din is the equivalent of what we would say is, let's say, kind of the Department of Justice, so to speak, in that regard. Because in those days, the Beis Din played different roles. They did legislative activities. They also performed executive functions. So there are a lot of different pieces of this. Not just judiciary. So this is a good example of a shaila. Can the rabbinic court, could the local authorities, intervene and break someone's privacy for the sake of some other? And of course, there has to be a counterbalance in terms of values. Yeah.
It would just seem to me that in terms of the Beijing, isn't it usually a case by case issue?
Yes.
So they're not going to blanket say, okay, anytime someone comes, we're going to do it. Whereas with Apple. It's, you know, like the dominoes. Okay, we did it for this person, and the government thinks that this person, there's a reason to do it. So that, to me, it would be much more dire consequences giving the government, you know, the ability to go through the Apple phones.
One can make the opposite argument and say it's exactly the same. The Department of Justice, they claim, we're not going to come to Apple every 5 minutes and ask for everybody's iPhone around here. The Department of Justice is not interested in you and your mother-in-law and your daughters-in-law and anybody else in your family. They don't care. Leave them. They're happy to... And I want you to know, I think it's in their own interest also to protect people's privacy. You know, they're not looking to snoop for the sake of snooping, at least I assume, unless you have any... people have other thoughts. You know, watch out.
Big Brother is watching.
Exactly. And the Beis Din, one can make the same case. If you're going to set a case of precedent, if one tshuva is going to say that it's mutter, so then, no, they're going to say it's mutter in case A, well, what about case B? The question with the San Bernardino story, when that broke, is maybe you could say, look, it's over. You know, you want to find out how pertinent is that, as opposed to, let's say, you have a case, Rahmanul Itzlan, sometimes they have, not so much here, but sometimes in Israel you have they call it a ticking time bomb. They find somebody, they want information, they need it now. They're afraid to wait 5 minutes or an hour or 2 hours. They need to find that information right now, the Shin Bet or whoever. So then they go to the authorities and they say, we need to get information. So that would be an extreme case. Of course, pikuach nefesh. Of course, you can open somebody's mail. You can open their email for pikuach nefesh. There's no such thing as saying privacy is going to stand before pikuach nefesh of a ticking time bomb. But it's a continuum. It's not pashut. So let's go to one last piece on this. And that's the Aruch HaShulchan on page 5. So the Aruch HaShulchan is living in Nevardik now. The Vichil Michel Epstein, only a little over 100 years ago, Sigismund. So Aruch HaShulchan says, he quotes the Schem Rabbeinu Gershom of not to read Shelo Likro Michtav Bechaver Shelo Brishu So Elam Kein Zarko. Now he says something very fascinating. Va'ani Mistapek. I'm not sure. Bizmana said today, Shaharbe Sholchem Michtavim Psuchim. A lot of people send open letters. What are the open letters he's talking
about?
Postcards. Postcards. It's a whole different world. Mechtavim psuchim. Or telegrams. So people are sending mechtavim psuchim, postcards. Al habei doar. Doar today in modern Hebrew is the male. Ha'im mutar likro bahem kevon she'eino mastir oso. Is it permitted? I'm the Yentisha mail carrier, and I see everybody's postcards. Do I have to turn them over to the other side? Or can I say, look, they're writing a postcard. Whatever they're going to write there, it's for everybody to see. So he's misupak. What's the suffix? I wonder if you say, is there an implicit mechila? Is there an implicit license that's being given by the fact that you're opening it up? The proof to that might be the fact that we said that if the recipient throws it in the garbage, then anybody's allowed to read it. Well, isn't this the equivalent of throwing it in the garbage? You're leaving it for the mail. Or you might say, no, I'm not expecting everybody and their, you know, their uncle to be reading my mail. I'm putting it in the mail. Who's looking at the mail? Maybe two mail carriers. That doesn't mean that I could post it on Instagram or on any of these other Snapchat. Because think about that for a second. There's a big difference between Instagram, Snapchat, or whatever Facebook people, I don't know what they're doing now. I'm not saying Facebook, because that's already old. I was told that's old. So that's why I don't do it, because I'm more hip than that. I don't do Facebook. I'm much more modern than that. Although I will say, if anybody has a chance, I could send it out. Take a quick look. There is an awesome petition that I would encourage you to consider signing that's going around. And this is a great use of technology. The great professor Schneer Lyman is involved in this. I don't know if somebody gets Skokie Shuls. So we post on Skokie Shuls. There is a movement in Lithuania to build a new convention center on the site of the old Jewish cemetery in Vilna, where there is already a building there on top of hundreds of graves, and there is a kind of a movement. So there was a woman in Vilna who was trying to get signatures going up. So for 3 weeks, she had this petition going on, and she only had a couple of hundred signatures. In the last three or four days since Motsoi Shabbos, I saw it, there were 400 and some signatures. Now there are almost 15,000 signatures on this petition to save.
I said it like 2 days ago, it was 2,600.
Yeah, now there are almost 15,000 signatures. So if you haven't seen it, take a look. It's at change.org, and it's a petition to save the, you know, the covet of these, you know. It's a horrible thought even to imagine. It's a very powerful thing, yeah.
When I sent that to somebody, they sent back that they should be aware of the last time in Chernobyl when they did it over a Jewish cemetery, that's when it blew up over Jewish.
All right, so I can't speak about that. That's me.
I don't know. Know that if there were 3,000, then they would really look at it.
So Dr. Lyman said in his note that he thought that they would take it seriously for 3,000. Now there are 15,000. And then he wrote to me afterwards. He's a cousin of ours. So when I got this, I sent it out and I CC'd him. He wrote to me afterwards that he knows personally several Jews in Vilna who are risking their life for this. Because he said, if you speak out against the Lithuanian government, that's not necessarily something you want to be doing on a, you know, on a healthy basis. So he said, we owe it to them just as chizuk that they should know that other Jews care about these few remaining Jews in Vilna. So if you haven't seen it, you can email me or you can go to change.org. But this is an example of the koach of the, you know, what the technology is doing. But anyway, going back here, so now we circle back to our email and our Russian hacking friends. So now you have the suffix of the Aruch HaShulchan. So Google, they could read my email. They can, right? That's part of, I assume that's part of the license agreement that I don't read. I just say yes. Right? They own Google, Gmail, so they can read my email. So does that mean now that it's like the postcard of the Aruch HaShulchan?
Which part? They're reading it or the Russians reading it?
So I don't know. Do you say, could you make the argument that, well, since anybody in Google, and I don't know, I didn't read the small print, since the Google people can read it, if they had nothing better to do in Silicon Valley, so then maybe now it's not protected writing.
But that would be a disclaimer that some people have.
I don't know. Do you have the right to say it's confidential, but at the same time, you're acknowledging that your server, so maybe the server that they're using is confidential, but the recipient is not necessarily.
In most of many offices, your emails are not private to your employer, because they own the computer system, and they could at any time look in on what you're sending.
That's right.
So, in with Google or Gmail, they may have the same similar.
I don't know what they're right.
On the other hand, I don't think the Russians would have a right.
Oh, but so that's the suffix. But Lahore, isn't that the suffix of the Aruch HaShulchan, which is the Aruch HaShulchan is saying, you know, I'm wondering if some John Doe can read the postcard, not the mail person. It's, you know, obviously the mail person can read the postcard because it's being given to them to deliver. The question is, can somebody else? Can the Russians claim, well, now it's no longer confidential? Because if everybody in your office can read it,
no,
then...
No, not everybody in my office.
Oh, okay. Great.
And the same thing with your Google or Gmail. They can read it.
Great.
They own it.
And, right.
Right.
There's a difference.
Right, so you can...
But the Russians don't own it. On the other hand, the Russians might claim that this is their very strong interest, like the Jew who had to look between the two goyim. And they have to look at it because...
National security
might be at
stake. 100%. And this goes back to the slippery slope question of, you know, what's important? Well, maybe, I don't know, maybe my... I don't know, my email to the shul office is very important to the rabbi, and he needs to know what's going on. What's that?
They need to know in the past tense.
Exactly. Like, they need to know, exactly. So people are going to be like hacking into Rabbi Liebtag's email to find out, you know, did he really get the kula that we were looking for, or is it just being machmer to make us crazy?
Yeah, I think you have to.
No.
I think you have to assume. And you're sending, there's a fairly famous case that took place a few years ago where phone messages were exchanged between some lawyers.
Yes.
And one of the lawyers said some things which were just so outrageous and outlandish that the guy who got the message, that he left the message on this other lawyer's phone, began sending that message around to everybody he could think of because he wanted to embarrass the other lawyer.
Yeah.
So you have to make an assumption that if you send something like email or whatever, that it's going to be read publicly.
Okay, or you could say the opposite. You could say that you should have an assumption of confidence. Maybe, and I want to wrap this up because I just want to have some final thoughts because before it gets late. Maybe part of this question, I'll get back to that in 1 minute when we see the Gemara, maybe this issue about the Russians may depend, as you alluded to, on the rationale for not reading somebody else's mail. You know, if it's about v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, so then, well, I'm not sure how much v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha Putin and Hillary Clinton have going on over there. So, like, he might just say, you know what, we're going to, you know, we know you're spying on us, we're spying on you, everybody's spying on everybody else. So there's a, you know, there's an understanding that in the world of espionage, that's what we do. And there is no v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. Everybody's cool with that. You know, maybe, I don't know. If it's an issue of Gnevas Das, so then you have to ask yourself, wait a second, does Gnevas Das always apply? Or sometimes people lend themselves, they open themselves up to misinterpretation, and that's their own fault. You know, if you have a teacher who leaves an exam for a group of high school students on the front desk when they're proctoring an exam, and they go out to take a cell phone call for an hour and a half, so then that's not Gnevas Das anymore. That's what the Gemara says, Iu de'ito anafshe. That's just being a moron. You know, you can't expect there's not going to be any Gnevas Das going on there. You know, there was the whole... Yeah, that's also with Ne'iver, Messiah, it's all a lot of bad things. But so maybe this is part of the question. Depending on what the issue of the Cherem is, you know, that will drive the limitation on how much access somebody shouldn't have. But I think at the end of the day, everybody agrees that from an immoral and ethical standpoint, this is something that's highly questionable. And part of the root of that is what the Chofetz Chaim writes in Hilchos Rechilos, which is that if somebody tells you something, that should be considered... I didn't put it in the source packet. If the Chofetz Chaim tells you something, you should consider that private information. Every conversation should be assumed to be kept in confidence. You know, there's a pasuk in Mishlei, Holich Rachel Megala Sod. A gossiper is somebody who tells things that are sowed, that are kept in a small circle of people. And that's one of the basic building blocks of Hilchos Lashon Hara, of not being a Holich Rachel, not just being a gossiper, because things should be assumed to be in confidence. And it's amazing, that's what the Gemara says on page 6, and this is what you were alluding to, that I think the opposite is true. What does it say? Vayadab Hashem El Moshe Lemor. Says the Gemara on page 6. Minayin Leomer Dover Lachaver Shubabal Yomar. How do we know that it's true that when I say something to somebody else, that it is Babal Yomar, that it should not be repeated? Ad Shiomar Lo Lech Emor. I send you a text message. The assumption is you should not copy and forward it to somebody else unless I say it's okay. Shenemar Vayadab Hashem Elov Me'ol Moed Lemor. Had it not said lay more, Moshe Rabbeinu would have to assume that the conversation is in confidence and that he can't tell it to the people. So every time it says Vayadab Hashem Moshe lay more, it's Hashem telling him, don't worry, it's not just between us. But the Gemara is assuming that had it not said that, we would have to presume confidence.
And that doesn't change by subculture? That's just like an overall rule?
So why is that? So I wonder if that goes to the next Gemara. Now, obviously, if sometimes there is an assumption that it could or should be shared, so then you could have what's called an anansadi, you can have like a working assumption.
It's like you borrowing a Torah from somebody.
Right, so sometimes, but the Gemara is saying that the assumption is that unless you have a message, and sometimes that message could be a condition that's, you know, sometimes it's unspoken, but the default is that it should be in confidence. And maybe this goes to page number 7. The Gemara in Bava Basra says that a person shouldn't open, you shouldn't build, let's say you're building an apartment building, or you're building two houses in certain neighborhoods. You have two houses that are so close together, and the way that it's structured, some of us have visited neighborhoods like this, I stick my hand outside the bathroom window, I'm brushing the next guy's teeth. Mamish, that's how it's going. So the Gemara says, basically, you should have frosted glass windows in those domiciles. Yigamar Misha says you shouldn't have Pesach keneged Pesach, v'chalon keneged chalon. If you have a studio one-bedroom apartment where everything is, it's all out there, so you shouldn't build an apartment building where my door of my studio apartment opens directly into your door of your studio apartment. Because then when I open my door and you open your door, I see exactly what's going on in your house, and you see what's going on in my house, because the Gemara says there's something called privacy, which, as we know, is being diluted and lost in today's culture. But I wonder if that's part of what underlies this idea. And that is that there is a concept of privacy. So there's confidentiality and then there's privacy, but I think there's some overlap there. That a conversation that two people have, that's meant to be kept private. And there's something sacred about that. And we're in a culture where sharing, you know, you get an article and there's a thing on the newspaper, it says share. You know, sharing is ubiquitous and sharing is great. We love sharing. You know, Judaism is very pro-sharing, especially in pre-nursery. It's very important to share. Sharing is good. But the idea of sharing information should give us pause, because the Chafetz Chaim tells us that we have to be sensitive to what may happen with that information. You may have the best intentions, but sometimes it runs afoul of what we call avak lashon hara. Somebody pulls in. The Gemara gives an example of the Chafetz Chaim quotes this. Somebody pulls into the neighborhood and they get at 11:30 at night. Their flight gets delayed. They come in late. So they want to know, you know, where they can get a bite to eat. So yeah. Somebody says to them, what's that?
Yeah.
No, in somebody's house. Of course, everything is closed. So they say, so somebody says, you know, such and such a person, the house, the stove is always on in their kitchen. So you can interpret that in two ways. One is that they always keep their house warm, which is true in our house. That was always to be warm. Or they're such fressers that they're always barbecuing. Now, for Yeshiva Bachrim, that's assumed. There's always barbecuing going on all hours, the camp, the day and the night. There's barbecuing all the time. But for regular people, if somebody said about you that you're always barbecuing at 11:30 at night, that might not be the most flattering thing. So even that is a question about Lashon Hara. So the idea is that when you have information about someone, sharing it is something that you should think twice and three times about. And so that, I think, is what underlies the whole discussion, or may underlie the whole discussion about the Chayim D'Rabbeinu Gershom, that when you pry into somebody else's mail, you're breaking into their personal space. And that you need to respect people's personal space. And that personal space transcends communication in different ways. So today it might be through, You know. Sometimes you have a person posts an unflattering photograph of somebody on one of these social media sites. So if someone
forwards that on. So is that a violation of the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom? I can't say if it's a formal violation of the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom, because I don't know if Rabbeinu Gershom applies to Snapchat. That's a question. You know, we have to think about all the different reasons. But forwarding that on is really, it's really hurting that person, and it's breaking into their privacy. Now, whether they did the right thing or the wrong thing by dressing that way or speaking that way or doing that thing, that's not the issue. And that's what we need to remember. Just because somebody does something wrong, just because they leave a ridiculous message, doesn't mean that you should then take that message and forward it to 100 other people. It should be assumed to be confidential. And people should, we should try, and it's a struggle today, to maintain as much in terms of the personal dignity and the privacy that goes with it. Yeah, Lewis, what were we going to say?
Isn't there a major difference between individuals where I agree, you know, it should all be assumed private, and then when you get these cases which, you know, everybody loves to quote, you know, the Russian hacking, whatever, where it's not the same rules that apply. The same way, you know, if theoretically that Jewish kid Rich that got killed in Washington, they say he didn't approve of, you know, all of the things he might have leaked to WikiLeaks, he would be more in the category of Edward Snowden, where, you know, he was not trying to reveal personal information. He was saying that there's something afoul in our government. You know, that's not the same thing as, you know, breaking this violation. And especially when the halakha was sensitive that you were allowed to take the letter and opening it if you thought it affected you financially. You know, this is much more global.
So I think what you're raising, the question that you're raising is, well, what about whistleblowing? Right, so that gets into the question of Lashon Hara L'Toeles. And the Chafetz Chaim has a series, I don't remember all of them offhand, a series of checks that you have to do, boxes you need to check before you start with Lashon Hara L'Toeles. And even Lashon Hara L'Toeles, there are probably different ways of doing that. And, you know, there are probably different gradations of how severe, you know, somebody like Edward Snowden, so, you know, I don't know exactly.
I'm not saying it was right.
Right.
It's a different category.
It's a different category, but one might say the category is in the reverse. One might say that he's a rodef, you know, and I use that term not halacha lamaisa. Nobody should think that anybody would not use it. I'm just saying it's, but it's, you're right.
Set of rules.
Well, I'm not sure that it's a different set of rules. I think that you need to calibrate the, it's the same rules, but calibrating the calculation differently because your cost benefit is different. It's different. Spying, you know, reading somebody else's email, what's your toelis versus, you know, I'm doing this for a particular toelis, which is true in also in just basic interpersonal communication. I find out something about a family member. So sometimes I need to break that confidence, and that is a violation of breaking their confidence for a greater purpose because I need to help them. I need to get them the thing that they need, and they don't even necessarily know that they need it. I need to speak to such and such a person, and that gets into the whole confidentiality, breaking confidentiality. That's part of like the subtext of this. And I agree that sometimes the stakes are different when you're talking about on a global level, but I think the principles still need to be thought through. You know, the principle of Lo Selech Rachel Ba'amecha and Ve'ahavta L'Recha Kamocha and Ganeva Stas, well, how do those things play out on a national level? Yes, we're concerned about things that happen in our government and things that, you know, we find are problematic, but we have to figure out how that stacks up against some of these concerns on the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom.
We also know that the Chafetz Chaim said that if you know something about someone that
yes.
would that you have an obligation.
Absolutely.
If that person is a fraud, a crook.
Absolutely.
And someone else you know is making a deal with them.
Absolutely.
Actually
yes.
That.
Yes.
So
that's.
Wouldn't that tie in with some national secret that would cause great harm to a lot of people?
Yeah, that's what Lewis is alluding to. The counterbalance of the Lashon Hara is
that.
The what we would call the Lo Samar al Dam Reyecha. I once asked this, Rav Schwartz, Shlita, Shalivim and be well, Shefer, Fuh Shalema. I once asked this question, you know, he said to me, sometimes somebody calls you about someone. He says, you have to be just as careful about the Lo Samar al Dam Reyecha, not letting that person fall into a trap. Somebody calls you about, you know, a recommendation for a shidduch for somebody or a business opportunity for somebody. So, you know, on the one hand, you have the Lashon Hara parameters, but on the other hand, you have the Lo Samar al Dam Reyecha parameters, and so you don't want to err in either side. You know, if you don't disclose information that they ask you, that's important for them, so then you're setting them up for a fail. That's lifnei iver also. You're giving them bad advice. So I think it's a fascinating discussion, and yet, what do we see at the end of the day always? We see how the Chazal and the tradition has so much to say, how Yiddishkeit is so rich, even on the most modern questions. I think it's really quite fascinating. All right, Yashikoach, everybody.